Hi, everyone. Thanks for inviting me back. I'm sorry I'm a little bit smiley. The University of Pittsfield I've never been to. I'm just thinking of Pittsfield having a university, and I'm just like, good for Pittsfield. That's the University of Pittsburgh. Oh, it's okay. It's just really loud. The University of Pittsfield. Beautiful area. Not super large, right? So, yeah, right? There's an argument to be made. I mean, lived in Pittsburgh for a while. I like it there, but I can see the argument for Pittsfield, too. So I'm really happy to be here today, and it's kind of a different talk for me, actually, because the last couple times that I've come to speak here, I've been kind of, what would you like to talk about, Justin? And I come up with something, and then I come here, and I bore everyone for 15 or 20 minutes, and then I go about my business. But this time is interesting because Herb, who asked me to do another talk here, actually said, we'd like you to talk about the first principle of Unitarian Universalism. And that was something that was interesting for trying to make a talk tailored specifically to the church and specifically to your community. And here's why. So, having done talks here before and just kind of existing in the world, I understood what Unitarian Universalism was all about as far as the religious communities, very liberals, very tolerant, inclusive. But what I didn't really understand was exactly how the history of this organization functioned. So when I started looking at the first principles, I found them to be really commendable. And for those of you that don't know, the religion operates off of, or the community operates off of, seven basic principles that form the underpinning of the community. And the first principle that we're going to be talking about today, the preeminent one, is that it presupposes the inherent worth and dignity of every human being, which is very admirable, I would argue. But here's the really interesting thing. Those first principles of Unitarian Universalism in its present form only goes back to 1960, when the Universalist and Unitarian churches emerged. But as faith-based communities, they go back all the way to the late 18th century. The Universalist Church of America was founded in 1793, and the American Unitarian Association was founded in 1825. Do any of you know, I'm sure some of you know, you've been in this community longer than me, how old the first principles are, these seven principles that guide the church community? How old are they? Does anybody have any idea? I'm sure our guests don't. You guys don't feel like I'm calling on you. No idea.
We're teaching the principles for the kids this year, and so I haven't thought even to look about
this. Yeah, right. Well, why would you? They're great principles. Let's just teach them as is, right? Everybody, take a guess. There's no wrong answers. Just take a stab at it. We've got an organization that goes back to 1793. At its oldest. 1970, close.
1961,
close. Yep, go ahead. No, you know, it's a good guess. All right, the two organizations fused, and they bought a motorcycle, and then they also came up with these principles. No, the principles were actually codified and accepted permanently in 1985. Only 33 years has this been the guiding political organization. It's number one, the first principles, only 33 years old. And the mechanism by which it actually came to being is in and of itself very interesting and very democratic, actually. So the original principles of Unitarian Universalism were rooted in this organization's originally liberal Christian faith, right? So there was a lot of references to the brotherhood of man, to the fellowship of all humankind, but it was very heavily gendered. And during the 1970s, women's organizations, and specifically the Unitarian Universalist Women's Foundation, or Federation, started contesting that and saying, well, this is actually excluding a huge number of people. And in the process of making their points and going out into the community and writing, this actually spurred the creation of these first principles, right? That they codified them, brought them to consensus. They were accepted in 1984 at the General Assembly, and then they were formally accepted again the following year and became established. And what's really interesting to me about that is that the history of this very democratic process of creating these principles, and these principles are in and of themselves very democratic. This first principle in particular, the inherent worth and dignity of every human being, is a foundational principle of this church. I would argue many of us would consider to be highly American. I mean, how familiar does that sound? The inherent worth and dignity of every human being. We believe these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created but endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. This principle of equality, this principle of that all human beings, regardless of station, regardless of function, deserve the same basic rights, recognition of those rights, and a certain level of treatment on the basis of that ineluctable quality bestowed upon them just by dint of being human. That's as American as apple pie. But here's the problem. How well can you exercise your rights? How much dignity can you really be accorded if you're not allowed to have a voice in society? If you're not given the ability to have your opinions heard, if you're not recognized, does it matter that people are going to treat you with dignity if you are functionally invisible? Not really. And that's the foundational bedrock principle of our system of government. The democratic principle of government exists and asserts that all human beings, by dint of being human and having these basic rights, should have a role in the governmental process. You should be heard, whether that's directly or indirectly. Because you are human, you have the right to be heard. Now, we all know the Founding Fathers, not the most progressive in the grand scheme of things by modern standards, right? A bunch of rich white slave owners getting together and deciding who would and would not have a voice in government. But over time, this principle is something that was enshrined in the American system of governance. But I would actually argue that it is fundamentally in conflict with the world that we live in today. That this principle, that an idea that everybody has an inherent worth and value, is actually being perpetually eroded and is in constant tension with the other major facet of American life. And that is the insistence, the embracing, and the glorification of a free market economy. I mean, to some extent, I know I'm preaching to the choir in here because of the self-selecting demographics of this community. But on the other hand, this is something that's worth stopping and thinking about. At a very basic level, a democratic system of government presupposes that all people are equal fundamentally. They have the right to be heard. What does a market, at its essential core belief of a market, what does that assume about merit and value?
Everything has a price.
Everything has a price. And everything can have a price too. Everything would be $5, right? I've been to a, you go to the dollar store, which is actually the dollar store, not just discount Walmart. Everything's $1. You can have everything with a price, but everything can be the same. In a true market, what does it assume? What does it assume about value, about the merits of things? How is it paid? Okay, so money is the most important thing, but how do you decide who gets the most money, right? Who decides? How's that decided? How do we determine what's worth what? Why is this a dollar? Why is that $5? I just saw a hand back there. What? Any idea?
Squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Squeaky wheel gets the grease, so if you complain loud enough, or if you're exerting any kind of sort of coercion on people, whether that's through annoyance or physical force, you can get more. Yeah, I don't get it.
Economics 101, supply and demand.
Supply and demand. And what is supply and demand? That's a basic principle of economics, right? But you know what underpins supply and demand? Worth is relative.
Right.
Merit is relative. It is relative to the function and the utility that you provide. That is the core assumption of a market. The core assumption of a market and free exchange of goods is that all goods have a value, and that value is based solely on its relative worth. In the eye of the beholder, the eye of the purchaser, the eye of the seller. That is the core assumption underpinning market economics. The right of people to barter and trade. Is that worth should be determined in a relative sense, not in a universal sense, not that we all have rights. Not, there's nothing ineluctable about value. It is determined by supply and demand, market forces, human agency and action, and that it is flexible. It goes up and down. Things become very valuable, things become very, very, very cheap. When you have a society that tries to hold to both of these principles, the assumption politically that everyone is created equal, but the social embracing, the cultural embracing of the principle that value is relative, these two principles are mutually corrosive. They corrode one another. They prevent one another from functioning properly. It's kind of an interesting, kind of an interesting anecdote. It's very rare that I want to bring in my own work and research to talk to, because most of you don't really care, I'm sure, about what's going on in the interwar 1920s, 1930s in Romania, which is where I did my dissertation research. But this is something that, a quote that I was actually, when I was thinking about this talk, that I remembered and it leapt out to me. So during the 1920s, in the United States, we had what was called the Gilded Age, right? The economy was roaring, the economy was hyperinflated by wealth that had generated the United States in the First World War. Industrial production was through the roof, new technologies, both physical and social. And as a result, a lot of people from overseas came to the United States to understand how the hell we were doing this. Like, how are you so rich? How is Ford producing all these cars? Like, how are you so wealthy? And this wasn't just people in developing countries, right? People from Germany, England, France. They were all coming here trying to understand what was going on. What was special about the United States that was making this possible? And one of the guys that came over, one of the subjects I was researching, was an engineer from Romania, which is not a wealthy country, was a very agricultural country at the time. And they were trying to understand, what's special about the United States? How do we understand that this principle, the democratic system of governments, this market economy, how does this work? It was really interesting. He went to these factories and he reported back on what he found. He wrote a book. And a couple government reports. And one of his most pressing observations was this. America is the country of universal human rights. But in America, workers don't have the right to anything. At best, they have the right to starve. To those who produce nothing, nothing is accorded. And he thought that was just perfect. He saw that as an admirable quality in American society. This was in 1926. He saw that as admirable. Why? Because it gave everybody incentive to work hard. And when you work hard, your true value is known, the economy becomes more efficient, there's fewer points of friction, and people can be rewarded on the basis of their contribution to society. That was the way he saw the United States operating in 1926. So you might be thinking, well, how is that relevant in 2018? We live in a society more riven by inequality than the society that Dionysia Mardan saw in 1926. Wealth inequality in the United States today is higher than it has been since 1913. It's actually really interesting if you look at this statistically. Well, interesting and depressing. So, 2013, the Congressional Budgetary Office, the CBO, which is about as neutral as you can get, nonpartisan, pointed out that the top 10% of Americans controlled 76% of the country's wealth, and the bottom 50% of Americans held 1% of the country's wealth. By wealth, I don't mean income. I don't mean how much they make per month. Their ability to control the generation of income. The bottom 50% of the population in terms of income, in terms of, controlled less than 1% collectively of the country's wealth, while the top 10% controlled 76% of the wealth. In 2011, the top 400 Americans owned more wealth than the bottom 50% combined. And of that 400 richest Americans, 60% of them had grown up rich. They grew up in privilege. They inherited their wealth. In 2013, here's another interesting statistic. The top 10% own 81% of all stock wealth, and the bottom 80% own less than 8% of total stock wealth. So as we were hearing at the beginning, when we talk about, you know, a homeless, you know, Pope Francis, an old homeless person dies, we hear nothing. If the stock market goes up or goes down by 2%, it's a big, huge deal. Not to 80% of our population, it's not. I'd like to ask you, how do you see democracy functioning in a society in which 80% of the people who are supposed to be accorded the same rights, the same opportunities, and the same basic treatment, the dignity, own so little of the country's wealth, are so materially worse off than the top 10%, the top 1%, the top 10th of 1%? If you don't have the same access to goods, to services, to money, to opportunity, your political voice starts to diminish. Because as soon as inequality based on demand starts cropping up, it limits access to decision makers and it makes people pay more attention to those with more resources. I would argue that the basic principle of American governance, that all men are created equal and we have certain electable rights, has become largely a fig leaf in our popular discourse. It's become a justification and an excuse for the accumulation of wealth and riches in the hands of the top 10%, the top 1%. Because if everybody's functionally equal, we all start the same, the cream rises to the top, and those who are wealthy deserve their wealth. They worked harder, they were smarter. Sometimes that's true. I'm not standing here telling you that the market as a thing is inherently good or evil. I'm just pointing out that it breeds inequality, but its basic principle is founded on inequality, and that it is in opposition to the basic principles of a society in which equality is recognized and an integral part of governance and cultural mores. So rather than end on a completely depressing note, I'd like to just point out and bring up this question, because this is what my wife was asking me about when I was talking to her about this stuff in the research I was doing. She goes, well, you can't just be a bummer. I was like, well, why not? People could used to be, we should all be bummed out. It's terrible news. So you gotta end on a high note. You gotta give people something to latch on to so they don't just walk away so depressed. And I said, well, okay. Honey, in the name of marital harmony, I'll make that happen. So what do we do with this information? Well, I would say that if you hold the principles of Unitarian Universalism to your heart, it's something you believe in and you value, which I believe you do if you're here. It means that you have to be aware yourselves in the way you think about the other people in your community, not just within your church, not just within government, but in general. We all in this country make assumptions about people based on their position in the economic order. We all, to a certain extent, are raised in a culture that ingrains that what you end up doing with your life determines your worth. That you should feel good or bad about yourself based on your economic function. You should feel good or bad about yourself based on who you married. This is particularly an issue for women, less so for men. What does your husband do? Well, he's a doctor. What does your husband do? Oh, he's unemployed. Oh. Those assumptions are baked into the way we interact with one another. If somebody tells you that they're a doctor, you're going to think about that person differently than if they're a janitor. And while I'm not going to stand here and tell you, it's all the same, everything's the same, because it's not. Trust me, as someone who's finishing their doctorate, I went to school for 10 years, right? I'd like that to mean something. But that doesn't mean that I'm worth more as a person than anybody else. It just means that the role in society, my economic function of providing education to people and interpreting the past and then passing that forward so we all understand how the hell we got where we are and how we can fix things before we're all living in a Mad Max-esque hellscape. That's just what I want to do with my life. It doesn't mean that I'm inherently worth more or less than somebody that cleans toilets for a living. And that's a hard thing to come to terms with, because I worked hard for my education. And for all of you out there, and the way you deal with people in the community, catch yourself in the way you think about people's role in society, and don't let yourself fall into the trap of assuming that just because what somebody does in the marketplace determines their relative wealth or their relative position within our society in terms of their material value, has anything whatsoever to do with them as a person. And try to look past that. See people for who they are, not for what they do. And that's the best I could do for her, so that's the best I can do for you, as far as somewhere to end. So on that note, I'm going to wrap it up, and then I think there's a time for responses or questions or thoughts or whatever, and if that's the case, then I'm curious to hear what you have to say. Hopefully that made some degree of sense better.